Enterprise Linux Security is brought to you by TuxCare, a company that helps you modernize your Linux security. Definitely check out TuxCare to see how they can help you automate Linux patching while minimizing downtime, staying compliant, and ensuring business continuity. Check them out at TuxCare.com. Hello, and welcome back to Enterprise Linux Security, episode 110, AI Wars. How you doing, Zhao?
All good. As always, a pleasure. Now that we got all of these things, the audio syncing out of the way. But yeah, everything is fine. As always, a pleasure being here with you. And today we have AI as the backstory. We have a couple of stories that touch on it. And we have some malware to dissect.
Yep, I guess it's probably a decent time to remind people I have an artificial insanity t-shirt, which is what I think AI stands for personally, off the record, of course. Well, it's on the record, but I mean, I'm not going to call it that in a video, but that's, you know, we go through these things. So I thought of an AI themed shirt. So a confused robot with artificial insanity on it was what I came up with, but it's at merch.learnlinux.tv if you want to support the channel. Also, check out TuxCare sponsoring this podcast. We really appreciate it. The link for that to check them out is also down in the description below. But now we're going to get into AI wars. And I want to prefix this with earlier in the podcast, probably multiple times, I think both of us have mentioned an opinion that eventually security will be fought on both sides with AI. You'll have threat actors using AI to create threats, and you'll have AI tools for security researchers to expand their efforts to try to combat those threats. So with that in mind, we have two stories that we want to go through today. The first is more or less the title story, and then we're going to get into something called AutoColor, which is kind of humorous because when I first saw the headline, I thought it was a bug in colorized output because Linux sysadmins and also developers love to have colorized terminals. And the first thing I thought was that somebody found a way to put a bug in there. But actually, it's nothing to do with that. We'll get into that story as a second story for today, but we're going to start with FunkSec is the group.
That's going to trip us up every time we say the name.
Yeah.
So there's this story about the new ransomware group. Everybody loves this. It's called FunkSec. Apparently, they came out in late 2024, and they claimed over 85 victims in December 2024 alone, which is significantly higher than other groups did in that month, or at least was announced from other groups. And the reason that this touches on AI is that by looking at the way that they create and deploy their attacks and the tools that they use, the analysis of that points to AI being used as the tool that enabled them to create such malware and the threat vectors that they used. Like you said, we've mentioned since the AI chatbots emerged and the way that they could help you code and create sometimes innovative solutions to problems, that it would inevitably be used to either attack or to defend in cybersecurity. And this is just a clear example of that. So these guys, they appear as a ransomware as a service operation. They seem to have some hacktivist leanings alongside the profit motives. It doesn't really make any difference for the victims. If it was politically motivated or financially motivated, you're just in trouble anyway. There doesn't seem to be connections to any established ransomware groups. There's limited information about their origins, even though some of their postings on the dark web and social networks and all of that point to being from Algeria or other North African nations. They use the typical double extortion tactic. They will steal your data and encrypt it on your own systems, so that even if you pay, you'll probably still have to end up paying again for them not to release the data, which again, not a good idea. You should never do that if you have the alternative. They have a really fancy data leak site where you can see your name listed if you're one of the victims, so that they force you to actually pay up. They offer distributed denial of service tools and ransomware tools. The demands that they make, unlike other groups, are relatively low. It's around $10,000. The others will usually aim higher, which, again, depends mostly on the victims.
And so we have a cyber criminal group with low self-esteem.
Actually, that ties into the rest of the story, because it's not just low self-esteem. It's actually low skills that are enhanced with AI. We will get into that. One thing that they have been seen doing is that they will sell the stolen data to other hackers at reduced prices. So it's like Walmart or Kmart or something like that. They do discounts for data.
Yeah, I was going to use a Walmart joke, but I'm glad you beat me to it.
So these guys, their operation was analyzed by Checkpoint. And their research, Checkpoint's research, suggests that they are likely AI-assisted. They use a custom encryptor that appears to be created by a relatively inexperienced malware author. These are Checkpoint's words, not ours. And despite the lack of technical expertise, the tools are being iterated very quickly, meaning that there are new versions coming out really quickly, so that the issues that they find on their own malware, they are fixing and correcting and releasing new versions out in the wild. So the way that they're doing this points to being some help in the form of some AI assistant, some coding assistant or something like that. And this, in fact, is where the big risk comes. It's not necessarily from them directly. It's from the way that AI is being used as an enabler for this type of attacks and for this type of operations. We've talked before about ransomware as a service and these large enterprises of criminals that even have employees of the month, and they have benefits and all of that for their members. And this is honest to God true. And these guys, the ones that are in those types of organizations, they actually have the skill sets. These ones, the FunkSec group, apparently, they just pick up code from wherever they can pick it up, and they will use ChatGPT or Claude or some other AI assistant and just enhance on that. And that's a problem, because if these guys can do it, then anybody can.
Yeah, and it's kind of always been the case that anyone can, because they're, you know, if we think about the fact that a threat actor only needs to pick up the phone and call a company and ask the receptionist for a password, and will oftentimes get it. Now, the difference here is that a higher skilled attack can be performed by that same low skilled person. So someone doesn't have the expertise to do something, you know, too advanced, then this gives them the ability to, it's another tool, but the problem is AI scales, and it scales very fast. So how it could produce the code and the threat vector and everything and lay it out. AI can generate code a lot faster. So now you can have somebody who previously would only be good enough to, you know, pick up the phone and get a password to do more complex attacks, because they could use AI to generate the code or whatever it is they're using for those attacks. And this gets right into our opinion where, you know, it's like the future of, you know, cybersecurity is going to be fought on both sides by AI, you know, good AI versus bad AI. It's not a sci-fi story. It's reality.
And as AI is getting cheaper and cheaper, this becomes more accessible. Claude specifically, the 3.5 and 3.7, now it really does create very good quality code. Before, you would get code from, say, ChatGPT or something like that on the 3.5 era, about a year ago, those faraway times, that was actually very low quality. You would have to go in and fix lots of mistakes yourself. It would easily get out of the context window, so it would just hallucinate parts of the code that didn't exist and assume it was there, and you had to fix that. Claude is actually pretty decent at doing that. The context window is huge, the code quality is great, and you can actually ask it for to solve complex problems, and it will give you workable solutions. So that's a problem. If you ask him, okay, give me an encrypted server client connection that can be easily deployable, say on Linux and on Windows, the server, for example, and it will work, and it will give you a working solution for that. And that just takes away lots of the skill that you need to know to create one of those things yourself. So the barrier to entry has been lowered considerably. It's not just about, you don't really need to know code that well anymore. And before, that was like the number one skill that you need to have to be able to be a proper hacker. Right now, it's much, much easier to do that.
Yeah, it's never been easier. I mean, it's just amazing how everything that we invent is going to also be used for the purposes of evil pretty much every single time. AI is used primarily by developers to enhance their abilities, or maybe, you know, in my case, speaking for myself, if I forgot how to do something, I might say, you know, write a function in this language that does X, Y, and Z. Oh, yeah, that's how you do it. And sometimes it's easier to do it that way than it is to look it up online. You know, how do you write a function in Rust? I could ask ChatGPT how to do the same in less time than it takes me to do a Google search. So if you imagine a threat actor wanting to, you know, create a backdoor or just have a command and control center, some connection to it, or any other of the many security types of vulnerabilities that we've spoke about, it becomes a lot easier, like you said, because you simply just need to ask your chat bot for whatever it is you're looking for, and there you go.
Another thing that's relevant about this new group is the, like I mentioned before, the political activism thing versus just cybercrime. There would be a difference. In some situations, there might be a difference about that. From the victim's point of view, it doesn't really make any difference if it was politically motivated or if it was financially motivated. It doesn't matter. If it happened to you, you're in trouble. You need to get your backups in order. You need to get assistance from law enforcement. The usual things that we recommend in that situation. But from a public perception around these guys, it might make them more endearing to the public than other types of groups. It might get some undeserved support simply because they claim to support some cause or a different one. Everybody knows how politically charged everything is these days, so if you claim to be for one side or the other, you will get, again, on one side or the other you'll get hate, on the other you'll get support. It doesn't really matter what you're doing. But it's worrisome that this is being used as a tactic in cybersecurity.
Yeah, we see our fair share of politically motivated and not politically motivated attacks. And like you said, it doesn't really change a whole lot from our perspective. We still lost our weekend either way.
When it's just a weekend.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, so Checkpoint researchers, they still believe that these guys are exaggerating the victim count. There's evidence that points to them recycling data from previous leaks, not necessarily new victims that they found. The primary goal appears to be gaining visibility, gaining recognition. This is where the activism part gets in and gives them some of that. The challenge about assessing the actual threat levels when the groups are self-reporting like this is that you don't really know if it's true or not. You don't really know if what they're claiming that to have done is actually true or not. We used to have some forced disclosure when you were hacked. I believe that's still in play, especially in the US. There is still legislation about this, or some mandate, or some whatever you want to call it, executive order. If that's the case, if it hasn't been revoked, there would be some mandated disclosure that needed to happen. But again, that would only apply to US-based firms and companies. These guys appear to be targeting not just US-based victims, but also in India. They appear to be very prevalent. And legislation might be different there. So it's difficult to actually gauge how relevant they really are or not. They claim 85 victims. You don't really know if it's really 85 victims or not, or if it's just one or two and the other are just made up. It's difficult to identify the real threat level here. But the issue is that given that it's so simple to do right now, you're going to see more of it. And again, you're going to have more problems identifying the real risk level from all of the groups that are going to appear every now and then. So this just complicates matters even more.
It really does. And I almost wonder if they have a CI/CD pipeline. I'd have to imagine. I mean, because some of the things you said kind of make me think that's the case, and I wouldn't be surprised at all. We talk about CI/CD as a means of testing your code in a isolated environment before it graduates. And I also kind of wonder if it's going to get more popular where companies will use AI to hack their own servers. You know, if we... what's the word for that? I'm so sorry. There's a word for hacking when it's good. I'm so sorry. I'm losing my words today. But anyway, when it's the person or the company or system admin that has permission to hack their own servers using AI to find vulnerabilities.
Penetration testing?
Yeah, well, I wasn't looking for penetration testing, but that's obviously what it is. Ethical hacking. That's what I was looking for. Ethical hacking. I can't believe I couldn't make myself come out of my head. But in another sense, I mean, there's all these use cases for it. It's just unfortunate that we have to deal with additional threat vectors every time a new technology is invented, because that seems to be the way it is.
And the reason that we know that it's AI, and the reason that Checkpoint claims that it's AI, is the quick iteration that they're doing. They're releasing new versions days apart, and they're adding new features with each new version. They're fixing bugs, they're adding new features. Checkpoint claims that version 1.5 specifically has improved evasion capabilities, and given the low level that they've shown throughout their operations, it doesn't really make much sense that they could do this on their own. So this is just another proof that they're having some help doing this. The fact that AI can do it means that they don't have to go to other groups to get that help.
Yep. So are we ready to talk about AutoColor, or did you have anything else you wanted to cover about that story?
There is one thing. It's obviously that we're going to see this as a growing problem moving forward. We need to improve the way that we assign risk to these types of groups. We're going to be seeing an influx of groups very quickly. We're going to be seeing many more threat groups appearing and having the tools to make themselves known. We probably need to find a way to identify when they are actually relevant and dangerous or just trying new stuff.
I think the whole thing needs an audit, the whole design of vulnerability reporting and scoring and everything, because it's really annoying anytime I see a critical vulnerability that requires, you know, physical access or something like that, which is kind of amusing. But then as we talk about someone's opinion or one person's opinion of how severe something is not going to match reality in all cases. And then, you know, don't even get me started about the kernel vulnerability reporting, because it's just a major disaster. But I definitely agree. That's needs a bit of a reworking, I would say.
I guess we can move on to AutoColor.
Yeah, so AutoColor is something that, well, today is March 5th, and the article that I'm reading from was actually dated for today. So, I take that back. This was back in January, as a matter of fact, but for some reason it was hitting my news feeds. There is a report that was today as well. So, AutoColor. So this one is a little interesting. It's targeting universities and government institutions. And what it is a Linux backdoor. And it basically runs in two modes. It either has root access or it doesn't. If it has root access, then it's going to stay on your system and is very good at evading means of removing it. So it's really difficult to remove. So I guess if you were a victim of this, you wouldn't just lose your weekend. You'd be losing a lot more time trying to patch this. And as an aside, when it gets to that point, just delete your server and start over. You can never really trust it again after that, especially with how deep this one goes. What it does, and this is interesting because the article mentions that it uses file name evasion by, you know, basically having a file on your server that has a name that you, oh yeah, that's okay, that's that thing. Something that would, be apparent to you is a good thing, even though it isn't. But when it mentions some of the names, for example, door or egg, I'm sorry, door does not seem harmless to me. Like if I see something running on my server named door, I have questions. Okay, that's extremely obvious. So I thought that was a little amusing that it included door in one of the harmless file names, because to me that's a, and probably anyone else, that's a red flag. So it runs with or without root privileges, like I was saying. The impact is less if it's not being run as root. Persistence is required, or root is required for persistence. But I would imagine a side channel attack, even if a threat actor did not have root access, they could then gain root access, because we have to be careful when we read something as not necessarily harmless, but if the scope is less because they don't have root privileges, a threat actor doesn't stop there. They don't look at it like, well, I don't have root privileges, so I'm just going to, you know, just use what I can. If another vulnerability exists and they're within reach of that vulnerability, that can then escalate their privileges to root. They're absolutely going to do that. And if you do have this malware on your system and they don't currently have root access, well, once they do get it, well, they'll obviously enable persistence, and then the it'll be there. So another interesting thing, and this is still breaking as far as I could tell, there's a kill switch on this one. So there's similarities with other vulnerabilities that we've talked about before, where kill switch is basically like an uninstall flag. So it means, or I read this as meaning that if you're the sysadmin, it's hard to remove, but if you could activate the kill switch, then supposedly it removes it. But its kill switch is focused on evading detection, so I wouldn't be surprised if it leaves a little something in the system to allow reinfection to be that much better or that much easier. One thing to mention too is the threat vector, the means by which you get infected isn't currently known. So I'm not able to report on, you know, how exactly your systems get infected, but there's a couple things that you could look for according to the article. So in your var log directory, which I'm sure all of us are very familiar with, if you see a cross subdirectory, CROSS, and then auto color underneath that, that's a glaring sign that you have this malware on your system. There's also library files put in the or placed in the etcld.preload directory, because the idea is that they want their libraries to be loaded before other libraries, and that's kind of key to its persistence. So, and I'm not going to say that, you know, you could tell whether you're infected or not solely by these files being present, because as we know, things change, or maybe they put things in a different place in a different version. But those are some obvious signs. If you have the autocolor subdirectory within var log, that's a pretty bad sign. But it's using C libraries to mask library names as libraries that you would actually expect to find on your system. So it's just one of those things. And this is common where people try to mask their infection or their infected server files by, you know, masking them as file names that you would expect. We've also seen some malware will try to stay under the 50% CPU usage window. I'm not saying this one does, but it's just another example of that where, you know, malware, it's not that they're trying to be nice to your server and not overload it, it's they want to evade detection. So they try to stay underneath your monitoring system's metrics so it doesn't start flagging the sysadmin that something's wrong. But in this case, it seems like file name hiding is going to be key to its success on the server. But it's, again, it's one of those stories where we don't really have all the information yet, but this is like the attack vector, for example. So it's really hard for me to say how dangerous or how likely I think this is to affect people, but it's just something to keep an eye on.
We actually don't know the actual attack vector that is used, but Palo Alto's Unit 42. And again, you'll need to really like these names. It's like Skunkworks. But yeah, so there's this really good analysis. You'll have the link, I believe, with the video. There's this pretty good analysis of the malware. So the thing that you were mentioning about the egg or backdoor or door or whatever it was, that's just to trigger the first stage of the malware, which is the installation. One thing that it does when it runs is that it checks the file name that it's running under. And this is actually pretty common under Linux when you have a tool that appears as different names and it will do different things when it has different names, like BusyBox, for example. BusyBox will work as any of the Linux tools, the standard tools, if you name it as such, like ls, like cat, you just need to rename it. So this is something that the malware actually does. It checks the name under which it's running. If it has one of those names that you mentioned, then it knows that it hasn't been deployed yet and it will start the installation process. Like you said, it drops a library with not that weird name. It's actually libcext.so.2.
Ah, yeah.
The idea there being masking it as a standard C library common to the system. There are lots of them there. If you go to the libraries directory, you'll find lots of them. And it will make sure that it loads first. Like you said, under etcldconfig, it makes sure that it loads itself first before other libraries. The reason that it does that is so that it can override certain functions in the system, like open, for example. When you write your code and you want to read something on the system, you will use something around open or file open or something to that effect. So the reason why it does that is that it wants to intercept certain system calls that might give away that the system is infected. One of the things that they analyzed and found was that it would, for example, interfere with monitoring tools. And the way that it does it, that it will intercept open calls to procnet TCP, which is usually where you see network connections that are active at the time. So it will intercept that connection when a program requests it. It will look at the list of connections that are up at the time. And if it sees its own connection to the command and control, it will take out that line and it will not report it to the program. So the program will effectively not see that connection. That's actually not the first time that that's in malware, but it's the first time that it actually tampers with the list, not just removes an entry. And the researchers, they actually had to go there and they had to point out that the malware had a bug. When it does that, it actually miscounts one of the lines and it fails when it sends back the count. So there's an error, an off by one mistake when it does that. So the researchers very smugly pointed out that, yeah, but they do this and they did a mistake. There's a bug in the malware. And apparently there is. If you look at the network list without using their library, it gives you a different numbering than when you do with their library. And it's not just about the connection that they're hiding. It's because that the way they process that list is actually buggy. But again, it's an evasion technique that they use.
Right. So basically, someone could be using netstat to check connections and not see it on that list, even though it's there.
Yeah.
Or should be there.
Yeah. And not just netstat, basically any other tool that monitors connections. I'm thinking about IPTraf, IPTrafNG, lots of different tools that rely on Procnet TCP for that. And it will cleanly hide away and not be able to be located that way. But not only that. It actually does more things, according to the analysis. It will actually prevent you from removing it from ldconfig. So it will actively try to prevent you from editing the configuration. And if you remove it somehow, it will reinfect and re-add itself to the list before you can do anything. So it's not that easy to clean just because you spotted that directory under varlog. Probably the best way to clean it at this point, and again, this is just my take on it, not the analysis, not the analyst's take, but you might want to take the system offline and just boot the system as a secondary hard disk or a secondary storage system on another Linux distribution and remove it there. It will actively try to prevent itself from being removed. What you said before about this being similar to something that we've seen in the past, yeah, when I was reading this story, it actually reminded me about that story that we did a few episodes back where there was this infection that came from the building across the street, the Wi-Fi network that reached across the street, and somehow it was used to breach a supposedly isolated network. Because the description of the malware in that incident is really, really close to this one. The way that it behaves, the way that it has that kill switch, the way that it can act as a proxy between different networks, all of those were things that were used on that incident. They don't make this connection in the analysis that they released. And on that story, they don't give us the name of the malware that was used. But the description on both, it could easily be exactly the same thing that they're talking about.
Yeah, there's a lot of similarities. The kill switch was the first one that I immediately clicked in my brain because I just thought that was so amusing. Oh, a kill switch. There's an uninstall feature. It's hard to remove, so I would imagine that kill switch would not be easy for the sysadmin to access. Otherwise, that would undermine all of their abilities. But yeah, there's definitely a lot of similarities. It's like they're getting inspiration from each other. Sometimes you have threat actor groups that are getting inspiration from others, or sometimes they're linked. It's just like this, you know, this community of evil in a way.
There are a few other standout things that these guys do. So they have their own custom encryption for configuration and communication with C2C. They develop their own algorithm for encryption, meaning that they're not using the standard libraries for this. And what this does is that first, it makes it really hard to crack because nobody else is supposed to know about this and know how to decrypt it. But additionally, it makes it not flag the vulnerability scanners and the threat scanners that are looking for uses of the encryption libraries where they shouldn't be. Your text editor doesn't need to encrypt in AES or DES, for example. So if it calls those functions, then something weird is going on. In this case, they don't use those functions. They don't use anything that resembles those functions. They develop their own stuff to encrypt. And that's interesting. And another thing is that every single sample that was found was different, had a different signature. It seems like they're custom tailoring each installer for each custom target that they have, meaning that one signature for one will not match a signature for another. It's the same malware, but there are some bits in the middle, some keys in the middle apparently used for the encryption routine that are individual and specific to that specific target. This is really, really interesting because you don't do that when you have, for example, a campaign that aims to target as many targets as possible. You do that when you want specific targets and you're going after specific systems that you want to infect. This makes it look more like an espionage attempt, just like the other incident when the network across the street was involved. It makes it look more like espionage than just simple ransomware.
And when it comes to developing your own crypto, you know, on the side of the threat actors, just like you said, that's going to help it evade being detected. But then it's a double-edged sword. The other edge of the sword is, you know, when we think of cryptography that we've had for a long time, it's been used for a long time. People have found bugs, reported the bugs, fixed the bugs. So I would imagine that there's a higher likelihood in threat actors' crypto developments to have bugs that, you know, like the FBI or other organizations can use, you know, against them. Because when you are developing software, I mean, for good purposes now, so you're developing a useful app that you think, or a messaging client, whatever it is, and it's strongly advised not to develop your own crypto. Use crypto that's been tried and true, that's been battle tested and hardened, because your app will benefit from that same work. But when you develop your own, you're going to make mistakes. You know, something could happen to where someone could break the encryption, not by knowing the encryption key, but by simply just knowing where the, you know, pinch point is, so to speak. So I would imagine that, you know, we could very easily have a story, and it'll probably happen, where a threat group develops their own crypto and then another group, you know, breaks right into it because they notice a bug. And I also think when you have people that have been working with crypto for a very long time, they kind of know where to look for these kinds of things, because they, just like, you know, I might talk about 10 things that sysadmins might run into when they start their job. They're going to know, well, the usual things that people do wrong when they develop crypto. And we've seen this in, you know, good applications that were not developed for evil, that someone just says, oh, I'll develop my own. What's the worst that could happen? And then something bad does happen, and then it's on the news. But I would imagine that that's going to, you know, poke some holes into their malware just on account of that.
The flip side of that is that they might consider that they have enough resources and enough skill to actually do it. And we know that not every group has that, but there are some state-sponsored actors that do. So, yeah, it might just be that on the other side.
Yeah, I agree.
And that ties directly into the attribution. So the guys that did the analysis, they don't really go into that. They don't really want to point fingers at anybody. But that specific point about developing their own encryption, that really points at somebody with deep pockets and very good resources, or a very good know-how on how to approach that. And if you think about it, for all the reasons that you just mentioned, the list kind of gets very small very quickly when you start to look at it. So yeah, they don't point their fingers, but everybody knows how the world is right now.
Yep, I agree. So we'll report more on this if we find out more. I mean, we still need to know how what the entry point is of the malware and how it's spread and how systems get infected, because that's an important thing to know. It's absolutely, you know, I mentioned a few things you can look for, but I'm always careful with that, because the minute I mention it, you know, they could change the file names tomorrow. So you can't really rely on that. But and just like you said, taking a, you know, hard drive or a virtual volume as a secondary volume, being able to get a full file list without anything obfuscating that, is definitely a way to do some forensic work to find out, you know, just how deeply your system's infected, if it's infected at all. So definitely stay vigilant.
The last thing that I want to mention about this one is that they actually made it very resilient, even to the command and control being taken down. The way that they configure the malware is that it can have built-in command and control addresses, but it can also take external configurations for it, meaning that it might connect to the initial command and control that it has and then receive instructions to, okay, from now on, you're going to connect to a different one. So the original command and control node might be taken down, but it might still remain active. The malware might still remain active. That's incredibly dangerous, by the way, because law enforcement usually goes after the command and control nodes and clear out these infections. We've seen that before when FBI triggered the kill switch on a different one, for example. We reported about that. But in this case, even the command and control portion of it appears to be very resilient.
Well, we'll be sure to keep you guys informed if we hear anything else about this. But, you know, like I said earlier, just stay vigilant. You know, if anything stands out as weird or just out of place, don't just pass it off. Just look into it and keep your eye on things and, you know, keep your eye on the news as well.
And patch your systems. We don't know the threat vector, but we don't need to make it easier for them. Patch your systems, patch your stuff. If you have updates, apply them. If you need live patching, talk to TechScare. We can help you with that. It makes it easier and non-disruptive.
There it is. That's true. All right. Well, I think that was our episode. I don't have anything else on my end, but, you know, we'll just wanted to catch up with the news, and we did that. Those are two things that are recently reported, and as always, we'll keep you informed.
Thank you, everybody who joined. It was always a pleasure. Until the next one. Bye.
See you next time.